Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest today is Scott Harrington, the Alan B. Miller Professor in the Healthcare Management and Insurance and Risk Management Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He is also an adjunct scholar for health policy at the American Enterprise Institute. Scott, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul.
Scott, you've got a great paper out right now on comparative effectiveness research, both in the public sector, that is at the NIH, Medicare and other agencies, and in the private sector, which we'll link to on our website. So I wanted to talk to you for a couple of minutes to begin our discussion on why are we talking about comparative effectiveness research? What does it mean? And why has it suddenly popped up to the top of the agenda of the healthcare discussion in Washington?
Sure. As everyone knows, healthcare costs are a major problem for the United States going forward. In particular, the problem of growing Medicare costs is having a major impact on federal budget deficits and has led to really some highly controversial proposals for reform. Comparative effectiveness research refers to any type of research that in essence tries to compare the clinical effectiveness of different treatments. One of the treatments may be watchful waiting, or there may be specific treatments that are being compared. The idea is to provide rigorous scientific evidence to the extent possible about the extent to which one treatment may produce better outcomes, better health outcomes than another treatment. There are a lot of people who have argued that one of the sources of high and rapidly growing healthcare costs in the United States is the widespread practice of medicine that doesn't have a strong evidentiary basis. And depending on who you want to read, some people claim that up to 50% of all medicine is really not based on rigorous scientific evidence. And the belief is, by many people, that if we had more evidence on what works, we could somehow then tailor medical care to sort of squeeze out low-valued care that doesn't have much, really care that doesn't have much clinical benefit. So that if docs and government bureaucrats and others had more evidence about what works, we could tailor the payment system or provide incentives for physicians and others to avoid providing care that has relatively little benefit but might have a relatively high cost. So as a result of that big problem, we have seen significant expenditures or proposed expenditures to have more public funding of comparative effectiveness research. And it really started in the stimulus bill, where there was an authorization for up to about just over $1 billion for government-funded comparative effectiveness research. And then that transitioned with the healthcare reform law, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. There was a transition so that now that research will be funded under the auspices of the new healthcare law. And in particular, the new healthcare law established a patient-centered outcomes research institute, which will be in charge of basically collecting applications, reviewing applications, and deciding how the money is going to be spent to fund specific types of comparative effectiveness research.
In a nutshell, we've got an argument here about the causes of why U.S. healthcare spending is going up so rapidly and seems to be going up unchecked. And the idea has been put out there that a lot of this variation we're seeing, or people are seeing at places like Dartmouth and other researchers, not based on evidence. If we had better evidence, and I can quote no better figure than our president, President Obama, who once said, you know, why should we be paying for the red pill if the blue pill is cheaper, just to paraphrase him. So I think part of the emphasis is in figuring out exactly which pill or which treatment or which surgery is truly clinically effective. Then there's this other issue lurking in the background of cost-effectiveness research, which is deciding what to pay for based on, you know, the bang for the buck that we get in research. So where is that debate so far, and how have the relative, to date, public and private efforts shaped up, and where is the information coming from on these topics?
First, about the distinction between cost-effectiveness analysis and comparative effectiveness analysis. Cost-effectiveness, as you suggested, will also try to provide evidence of what the incremental benefit from a particular treatment is in relationship to the cost. In contrast to comparative effectiveness, where you can simply compare treatment A to treatment B, and for example, whether it extends life, whether it deters tumor growth, and so on, with cost effectiveness, you have to try to somehow measure the benefit of any improvement in condition. And that might involve trying to put a monetary value on additional life years and adjusting for the quality of those additional years and so on. So it tends to be much more controversial than simply comparative effectiveness.
Because the degree of complexity is increased exponentially.
The degree of complexity is increased and involves much more judgment, a lot more subjectivity about how you will value a particular extension. So not only do you have the uncertainty about the impact of the treatment on some outcome measure, but then you have the tremendous uncertainty about how we should value any incremental improvement. And in the background of all this, of course, is the fear by some or the hope by others that this type of information, first comparative effectiveness research, but maybe ultimately cost effectiveness research, will provide the basis for determining what's reimbursed under public insurance programs and perhaps ultimately under private insurance programs. So there's naturally a great degree of angst by some and hope by others that we can use this information to more or less save money without reducing quality by deciding that we're only going to pay for what works and we're only going to pay for something that improves health outcomes if, according to some criterion, the value of the benefit is greater than the cost of the additional treatment. You had asked as well about sort of the state of public and private research. Well, the public part, there has been for many years an ongoing support of some comparative effectiveness research and some cost effectiveness research by leading government agencies such as the National Institutes of Health. And under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the funding that I talked about earlier, a lot of it will go through the National Institutes of Health and another federal agency to basically provide grant money largely to medical schools and related institutions to conduct specific types of comparative effectiveness research. There's also been, over time, comparative effectiveness research conducted by the Veterans Administration and other government entities that have provided some evidence about types of things that work better than others. In the private sector, it kind of flies under the radar screen, but there are a number of entities that are involved and a growing number of entities that are involved in actually undertaking various types of comparative effectiveness research. Often it doesn't move towards large-scale clinical trials where you have randomized controls and spend a lot of money trying to see what treatment works better than some others, but there are other research methods and survey instruments that can be used to try to provide evidence of comparative effectiveness. So some of these are basically organized and funded through the insurance mechanism. Blue Cross Blue Shield entities have a major mechanism where they access different technologies, primarily to try to determine whether a new technology is really innovative and improves care, as opposed to being experimental and untried. There are other entities that have come online in the past few years. There's one known as the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, which is run out of Massachusetts, that is doing a large number of comparative effectiveness studies, again, not involving randomized clinical trials, but synthesizing various types of evidence. There are private consulting-type subscription-based entities which are doing different types of analyses and summarizing information and making it available for a fee. And then we're seeing some, I think, pretty potentially exciting new collaborations. For example, WellPoint has been working with one of the major drug companies on an initiative that may provide some significant impetus for determining comparative effectiveness for certain pharmaceuticals. And more drug companies and device companies have been involved in doing more head-to-head comparisons of their compound versus other compounds or their device versus another device in recent years. So I would say we've had the impetus from public funding, but given improvements in technology and greater data availability, we're also seeing some non-trivial growth in private sector initiatives.
I think that's a really interesting point that you make in your paper. One of the arguments put out by people who think we need more public CER is that it's a public good, and either the private producers of that information can't capture the value of that information by selling it, or even if they could, distribute it to someone who was willing to pay for it, the total value of releasing that information out to everyone would be enormous, and you don't want to restrict that information. You want to get it out to everyone to capture the maximal gain from that evaluation. But you also point out that private organizations still have powerful incentives, particularly pharmaceutical companies who have to submit this kind of information to public and private payers or PBMs to promote their products in the marketplace. So some of this is being published naturally. But at the same time, you say the production of private CER is discouraged by how we've set up payment systems or tax systems for healthcare, particularly for Medicaid and for private health insurance. Could you explain that a bit and talk about how it discourages more private CER?
Sure. And I think it's a very important point. The problem, I think, in making the point is you get into, well, how are we going to fix that? And then we're right into the debate that no one seems to be resolved or really move forward on. But you can think of it this way. Doctors and patients have incentives to try to provide good care. But we've got an insurance and payment system that largely insulates patients, if they have insurance, from the cost of getting care. And it largely insulates providers from having to make decisions really based on the cost of care as opposed to getting their fees paid for providing particular types of services. In that environment, there is significantly less demand for information about whether a particular type of care that may be pretty costly is really providing much benefit. Because if all the costs are largely pooled through a private insurance mechanism, or they're pooled ultimately among enrollees and taxpayers through a system such as Medicare, people are disengaged from asking questions about, is this really worth the cost? And I give a really quick example in my paper. We know that there's been a great increase in costs of various types of expensive imaging, and this is involved with various injuries, including soft tissue injuries, lower back pain, and the like. Imaging often is very, very expensive. It's the evidence we do have suggests that imaging in many cases really may not influence the course of treatment. It's not obvious in many cases that it provides any significant benefit. When you've got a system where the insurance is going to pay largely for the cost of the test, it really dulls the incentives for both the patients and the doctors to have a demand for more rigorous information about whether that test is worth it. And that's just obviously one simple and quick example, but if we continue to evolve towards a system where consumers have more skin in the game and physicians are incentivized to recognize that, as well as maybe having other incentives to consider cost, you'll see a commensurate growth in private sector production of information. One thing that web technology and IT in general have accomplished in the past 10 to 15 years is we just have an explosion of entities that are thinking of really clever ways to be able to provide information when people want it. So I think we can be very, very confident that as consumers, if consumers become more concerned with healthcare costs and physicians similarly are more concerned, that we will see a large variety of innovation to try to provide that information and that there will be financial incentives that will drive the private sector to undertake that innovation, and that this sort of public good argument associated with information, although theoretically correct under narrow circumstances, is really in practice not sufficient to dull the provision of information in a way that makes a very strong case for more and more public provision.
Well, let me see if I can sum up a little bit. So ironically, some of the pooling mechanisms we have, either for the tax exclusion for employer-provided health insurance or Medicare, where 75% of enrollees are in fee-for-service medicine, where physicians are reimbursed for the quantity of services they provide, discourages private provision. So that would encourage us to move more in a direction of where patients have to consider more of the marginal costs, particularly for non-catastrophic injuries, to try and determine, well, is this extra service really worth the added cost? But also, to touch for a little bit on an earlier point I think we could end on, is that the government in these situations, no matter how fine a point you put on it, is in the business of picking winners and losers. And you can start out by trying to talk about clinical effectiveness, but I think you merge pretty quickly into the cost effectiveness question. But then it is the government picking winners and losers, and you run into all the complexity you spoke about earlier about how do you identify not just for a population or a subpopulation, but to try and give guidance down to the individual physician seeing a patient who that patient is, I bet in most cases, the doctor's going to say that's different than what you are seeing at the level of a randomized clinical trial.
Yes, that's exactly the case. And just to give a quick example, under the stimulus bill, money was authorized for the Institute of Medicine to conduct a study and establish priorities for comparative effectiveness research. And they undertook a massive task of soliciting input from over 20,000 people and numerous organizations. They had a web-based questionnaire. They had hearings. They had several rounds of voting. And they ended up identifying 100 priorities for comparative effectiveness research. And in the public documents that were available, they divided these into quartiles from highest priority to lowest priority. And if you look at the process that the IOM went through, and I'm not criticizing the process, but I think it illustrates the problem associated with having a centralized bureaucratic assessment of what really is important and what we should fund. And in the paper, I talk about some of the things that were labeled as high priority and some of the things that were labeled as low priority, where without going into the details about whether or not what particular people said, it would at least appear to illustrate the idea that politics will matter, that interest group pressure will matter, that problems that might not really seem to be that severe in terms of cost or the therapeutic value might get emphasized relative to much more costly medical technologies where we're spending a lot of money where it may be of marginal value. But in short, as you put it, the major advantage, and this really goes without saying, of having private sector involvement is it's decentralized. It'll be based on incentives for where people are willing to pay, what type of information may add value. And the decentralization is very important and useful as opposed to having a necessarily bureaucratic allocation process where at the end of the day, you may have very many smart people, but you're going to make these decisions based on a relatively small group of people picking what they think is important. And so it kind of cuts to the chase on, do we want decisions about medical care to be heavily influenced by a relatively small group of experts in a political lobbying context where all sorts of people are bringing pressure, or is it better to think about the incentives we can provide for private players, for individuals, entities, and the like to come up with ideas about how they can add value given their perception of possible demand?
I think that's a terrific point to conclude on. Scott, thanks very much for talking to us today, and we'll post your paper on our website, and we encourage people to read it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.